Good morning, Dr. Ross. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks, Brent. Lovely to talk to you, mate.
As always, the same. Couple of questions. Firstly, from Andrea. Andrea says, which I think is a good question. She's got two questions. Normally, we limit it to one, but I thought these were both good questions. So here we go. Question number one from Andrea. Dr. Ross, Andrea wants to know, what is the best position to sleep in? Front, back, left, or right side?
I think whichever side you're comfortable with. If you sleep on your back, there's a much higher rate of sleep apnea because if you're flat on your back, the tongue falls back, blocks the airway. But some people find it more comfortable to sleep on the back and they don't have bad sleep apnea, so that's fine. Some people find when they sleep on their left side, because the heart is on the left side and the heart pushes more against the left side of the chest when you sleep on your left side, they'll experience more palpitations doing that. But the reality is, in terms of whether it's good or bad for you, it doesn't matter. It's what you're comfortable with. And the key when anyone goes to sleep or when anyone wakes up, do you feel refreshed or unrefreshed? So if you've been asleep for 7 or 8 hours and you wake up unrefreshed, that's a bad sign and typically indicates you might have bad sleep apnea. But if you wake up refreshed, it doesn't matter how you sleep. You can sleep on your head if you want. I'm joking. But I'm saying it doesn't really matter as long as you wake refreshed.
What about an elevated position for sleeping, particularly if someone suffers from heartburn?
Oh, yeah. That's said to be good for people suffering reflux because if you're lying flat, the acid can come up very easily from the stomach, especially if you've got a bit of a hiatus hernia. And also there's another condition called POTS. Now, POTS stands for postural orthostatic tachycardia syndrome. And it's said that if you have the head of the bed up a little bit with that, it does relieve some of the symptoms, although I've never really seen it that as much of a benefit. But it's interesting that since we've had the pandemic with COVID, COVID can really inflame the reflexes around your blood vessels and bring out these POTS. So a lot of people are getting long COVID. A significant proportion of people are getting dizzy when they stand up. They can't stand for too long. They're finding their hearts racing in different positions, and that's all part of this POTS syndrome. And some of the suggested treatments for that is to avoid heavy meals, keep the grog down, don't get particularly dehydrated or very, very hot because your blood vessels open up, have the sleep with the head of your bed up a little bit. And also, interestingly, one of the best parts of the management for this is cold water swimming. So swimming in waters that's less than 20 degrees Celsius can actually help that as well. So head of the bed's not a bad thing to have up.
Andrea has another question. Yep. She says, is it better to breathe through your mouth or your nose?
Oh, the nose, definitely the nose. Mouth breathing is very bad for you. One of the best health books I've ever read was a book by a guy called James Nestor called Breathe. And what he did was he taped his nose for a week and just breathed through his mouth, and it caused all sorts of health issues. So no, breathing through your mouth is a really bad thing to do.
What about, of a night time, taping your mouth when you go to sleep so that you breathe through your nose, or you're forced to breathe through your nose? Mouth taping.
That's a very good thing to do. Reduces snoring, can improve the quality of your sleep. So you just get a little bit of micro pore tape and you just can tape your lips together. And often for some people, they should do that during the day as well.
They should, shouldn't they? Yeah, very true. I wanted to say also, is this good for sleep apnea as well?
Yeah. It's part of the suggested treatment for sleep apnea. And in fact, interestingly, we know that the best treatment for sleep apnea at the moment is nasal CPAP, and I'll come back to something else that's just been released this week. But nasal CPAP's the mask over your nose. But in the old days, the sleep apnea experts used to also suggest that people sleep with a tennis ball taped to their back to stop them rolling onto their back so they'd sleep on their side. So to reduce sleep apnea, it's much better for you to sleep on your side. Now, a study's just been released this week out of the US where they gave people tirzepatide, which is otherwise known as Mounjaro, which is the next step up from Ozempic. So Ozempic, everyone's using to lose weight, but we're finding that drugs like Ozempic, and tirzepatide is Ozempic, a bit like Ozempic with something else in it, It has the GLP-1 receptor agonist, which is the same as Ozempic, but it also affects a thing called GIP, which is gastrointestinal peptide, or sorry, glucointestinal peptide. And what that does is gives you even better weight loss. So when they compare Ozempic to tirzepatide head to head, there's a moderate benefit over with tirzepatide over the Ozempic. But they found when they gave it to people with sleep apnea, after 12 months, their sleep apnea improved as well. And I think one of the reasons for that is you're taking fat around from the all the tissues around your neck, and that improves the sleep apnea.
Andrew says, we talked about Ozempic last week. It seems to be the drug that everyone's talking about at the moment. Yep, Andrew wants to know. Andrew wants to know, do you just go to your GP and say, I want to start a course of Ozempic? Is that how it happens?
Yeah, that's how it happens. But everyone who is not a diabetic, it is not covered by the PBS system for them, and it does cost you $140 a month. And the point I want to make about Ozempic is that if just say you've been on it for 6 months or 12 months and you've reached your target weight, said, okay, I've dropped 15 kilos, which is the average weight loss for Ozempic over 12 months, then you say, well, I'm where I want to be. I'll stop it now. What happens is a huge rebound. And I make the analogy with cholesterol. You start with a cholesterol of 6. Your doctor puts you on a statin, drops it down to 4. If you stop the statin suddenly, your cholesterol rebounds up to 8. And it's the same thing with Ozempic and weight. So what I say to anybody who starts Ozempic, when you decide to come off Ozempic, because we don't know about the very long-term side effects of being on this drug, you don't just stop it suddenly because you'll get this rebound increase in weight. So I say to people, instead of having the weekly injection, have it then once a fortnight for about 3 months, then once a month for 3 months, then stop it.
Aren't we a funny lot, us humans? There was all this negative about COVID and it's only new and no one knows about the side effects and all these sort of things. Yep. And there was a myriad of number of reasons given as to why you shouldn't have it, yet it's similar to Ozempic. But we don't hear all the negatives, do we? Because you can lose weight and look better.
Yeah, can I say to you, mate, that is just such a brilliant observation. Because that's what human beings like. You have the anti-vaxxers coming out of the woodworks. These things are dreadful, not accepting the fact that it was vaccination that got us out of the pandemic. But the vaccinations have been the next thing to the devil for these people. But then when it comes to Ozempic, oh, no, I don't mind that. But I've seen vegetarians who say, I'm a vegetarian for health reasons. They smoke. just doesn't make any sense at all.
Merity says, could you please ask Dr. Ross what he thinks about Prolia injection for people with osteoporosis? She said, I've heard some bad reviews, so I've chosen not to have it.
Yeah. Now, look, the problem is if you read the package insert of any drug, you would never take any drug. So what they have to do, the drug companies have to do, is put in every potential side effect ever reported, because if they don't and someone gets that side effect, then the person's going to sue them. But the reality is, and I say this all the time, there's about a 10% side effect rate from all drugs. So I give any drug to anybody, no matter what it is, 90 think I'm a genius and 10 want to throw it at me. And you can't tell who's going to be in that 10%. Now, of all of the pharmaceutical preparations for osteoporosis, it is my opinion that Prolia is the most effective and the safest, but I'm not saying it's totally safe. It's like the vaccines. Vaccination is the safest medical treatment we have, but there are still potential side effects from any treatment. So look, Meredith, if you have osteoporosis, the worst thing for you is for that to get worse and for you to fall over and break your spine or break your femur or do something like that. Much more dangerous than a potential side effect from a highly effective drug like Prolia. But I also say to people, the thing about osteoporosis, like every other modern degenerative disease, it is a genetic disease. So your genes load the gun, then your environment pulls the trigger. So interestingly, people who are thinner have more osteoporosis than people who are carrying more weight, but it's still genetic. But the things that you can do before you start Prolia is the best treatment for osteoporosis is a thing called exercise. So 3 to 5 hours of exercise a week, that should be 2/3 cardio and definitely 1/3 resistance training. Number two, avoid fizzy drinks like the plague. So any soft drink, whether it's artificially sweetened or a sugar-sweetened soft drink, has a thing they call phosphoric acid that rips the calcium out of your bones. So don't have those. Number three, do not take oral calcium, because all that is basically chalk you're swallowing. And it's been shown in a number of studies not to stop osteoporosis or help it, and not to prevent bone fracture. Number four, take vitamin D at least 2,000 international units a day to get your vitamin D levels around 100. And number five, vitamin K2, 180 micrograms a day, that takes the calcium out of your arteries and puts it back in your bones. You do all of those things. If that doesn't work, my suggestion then is the best treatment we have at the moment, and there are newer treatments coming through, the best treatment at the moment is Prolia.
Research has found that Generation X are more susceptible to many types of cancers than prior generations. Yep. Of course, Generation X, for those taking notes, Generation X born roughly between 1965 and 1980, Ross.
The problem is we've seen an increasing trend of these cancers per head of population, compared with, say, the baby boomers, who just didn't seem to get as many of these cancers. And the weird thing is, when you look at them, for women, it's things like leukemia, non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, ovarian, pancreatic, colon, uterine, rectal, kidney and thyroid. For the men, prostate, rectal, kidney and thyroid. So what we're saying is that even though, of course, the greatest risk factor for cancer is getting older, so there are certainly more cancers in the baby boomers than there are in the Generation Xs. But what we're saying is that when you look at the cancers in Generation X, they're much more than when the baby boomers were the same age as them. But interestingly, the women, the Generation X women are less likely to get cervical cancer, obviously because of the vaccine, and lung cancer because less people are smoking. For the men, there's less non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, gallbladder cancer, liver cancer, and lung cancer, again, because of the reduced smoking rates. But I think the reason why we're seeing more cancers in the Generation X people are really two major things. Number one is because people are carrying more weight than they were in the baby boomer stage. So if you think about when you and I were in our 20s, 30s and 40s, we didn't see anywhere near the amount of obesity that we're now seeing in people in their 20s, 30s and 40s. And I think that is contributing to all the obesity-related cancers. But also the other thing is, over the last 20, 30 years, we've seen this absolute burgeoning of synthetic chemicals and environmental toxins that probably weren't as bad when you and I were kids. So I think that's another major factor there as well. And it's concerning. And what it's saying is we should really be very careful about all of the synthetic stuff we put in our bodies. But you think of it now. I would defy you to open your fridge and find something that's not in the plastic. And people say, oh, they're sucking on these drink bottles, these plastic drink bottles all day drinking water because they're told that water's good for them. But what they don't realise is that all the chemicals in the plastics are leaching into the water and I think causing problems as well. So it's not just that. It's the whole environmental exposure. 1 in 6 deaths now, Brent, around the world are directly related to air pollution, as one example.
I said to my wife last night, I said, darling, I'm going to start taking Viagra because it's, yep, going to improve the brain-blood flow and could help prevent dementia. And she said, oh, rubbish. I said, no, Dr. Ross told me that's true.
It is. It's absolutely true. And look, I don't call it Viagra. I call it vitamin D because I just think it's something that all men should be taking over the age of 50. And we don't know about women yet because the studies haven't been done in women. But what the study out of Oxford has shown, it's only a small amount of men, so it's 75 patients they did the study in, but these gentlemen had a prior stroke, and they found that when they gave them Viagra, it markedly improved the blood flow to their skull. And this is the key, and this is why I think Viagra is so good for you, is because it's a vasodilator. It just doesn't open the most important artery in a male's body. It opens arteries everywhere, into your brain, into your heart, into your bowel. And in fact, a study that I mentioned on my show about a year ago was a study of 72,000 men over 14 years, it showed that those who were the highest end users of Viagra or Cialis had a 55% reduction in all cardiac events and a 50% reduction in all-cause death. A study that was done on laboratory animals who were genetically primed to develop bowel cancer, those who were given Viagra had a 50% reduction in bowel cancer. And some of the different studies have shown now anywhere between a 20 to 70% reduction in dementia in men who regularly use drugs like Viagra or Cialis. So that's why I call it vitamin V.
When you say regularly use Viagra, yeah, what's that definition?
Well, look, I'd say for men over the age of 50, at least two, three times a week, that would be enough to do it. And some men prefer to use Cialis, which has a very long half-life. So I say to people, some of my patients, especially if they're struggling in the department that where these drugs are usually used for, you take a Cialis 5 milligrams every second day because it's got a very long half-life, and just top it up with vitamin V when you need it, so to speak.
Side effects of these medications, what are they?
Oh, well, the main ones is headache, because it opens up arteries, including the arteries to your skull. So a headache, facial flushing, nasal congestion, all of those sort of things. But they don't have any nasty side effects. They're just annoying side effects.
Ingestible microbiome sampling pill. Now, we've talked a little bit about this before, and yeah, this new technology, it's advancing, moving towards human clinical trials now, Ross.
Yeah, and see, this is important because there's so much talk, and you and I have spoken about it for years, on the importance of having a healthy gut microbiome. So all those nice little bacteria living in your colon. So you and I are 40 trillion human cells and anywhere between 40 to 100 trillion bacterial cells, most of them which reside in our colon. But the problem is, if you want to see how healthy your microbiome is, you just go off and give a stool sample. But the problem with that, it's just giving one sample of what you were passing at the time. And it's a bit like going into a forest and just walking into one bit of a forest and saying this is what the whole forest is like and this is the vegetation of the whole forest. Obviously, that's nonsense. And so it's also a bit of nonsense just doing one stool sample. So what this pill does is travel through the entire colon, sampling all the way through, and then you pass it out and collect it and give it to the pathology people. So it's a bit of a hassle, but it'll give you a much better view of the entire microbiome than it will just doing one stool sample.
There's evidence that suggests regular consumption of melatonin can reduce chances of age-related macular degeneration. Of course, this can lead to blindness.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the commonest causes of blindness, especially as we get older, with cataracts and things like that, glaucoma. And there's been a number of studies already suggesting a trend towards this, but a big study recently of just under 122,000 people over the age of 50 showed that those who were regular users of melatonin, which obviously is used, it's not a sedative, but what it does is reset your sleep cycle. And they found that the people who used melatonin had minimal evidence of age-related macular degeneration. And those who were showing signs of AMD, who started using melatonin, had a much slower degradation to age-related macular degeneration. So what it's saying is that there seems to be some significant collateral benefits from taking melatonin. And I've got to say, after I read this study, I don't typically use melatonin, but I've started using it because I've got a bit of a thing called drusen, which is a very early, it's not macular degeneration, but it's almost a benign marker that it may develop as you get older. So I've started taking melatonin myself.
And how much do you take and where do you get it from and how often do you take it?
For people over the age of, I think it's over the age of 60, you can just get it across the counter. It's a 2 milligram controlled release pill.
Side effects of it?
Oh, minimal, none. I mean, look, the problem with anything, any even natural things like melatonin, some people can still get some abdominal upsets or headaches or whatever. People get weird side effects to things. And most people, nothing at all. But maybe with things like melatonin, maybe 1% to 2% of people may get any of the side effects you can get with other drugs. Headaches, dizziness, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, constipation, skin rash. We're all weird. I saw a woman once 40 years ago when I was a resident who was allergic to apples. Can you imagine being allergic to apples? And she thought she was having a glass of champagne. She had a glass of apple cider and she had an anaphylactic reaction.
Just before I let you go, the sugar substitute xylitol is now linked to a higher risk of heart attack and stroke.
Yeah, and this is this study where they looked at 3,000 people in the US and Europe, and those who had the highest levels of xylitol in their bloodstream had a marked increase in cardiovascular risk over a three-year period. And they think the reason for this is that xylitol makes your platelets so much more sticky, and so therefore it's very easy for you to develop clots in your arteries.
All right, Dr. Ross, thank you as always for answering our listener questions. We appreciate it. If you've got any questions for Dr. Ross, you know what to do. You send them to me via email, and we'll ask the good doctor those questions next week. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, Ross.
Thanks, mate. Lovely to talk to you.